Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mark Zitter, chair of the Zetima Project, a member of the club's Board of Governors, and today's moderator. I'm very pleased to introduce today's speaker, Seema Verma, who is the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also known as CMS. Seema Verma is only the 15th person to be confirmed to this post. She was nominated by President Trump and confirmed by the U.S. Senate on March 13, 2017. As administrator, Ms. Verma oversees a trillion-dollar budget. Trillion-dollar budget. That's about 26% of all federal spending. And very importantly, those funds are spent on some of the most essential programs that our government provides, that is healthcare services, for more than 130 million elderly, vulnerable, low-income, and disabled Americans. In her career, Administrator Verma has guided healthcare policy in the public and the private sectors. She is a graduate of the University of Maryland and holds a master's degree in public health with a concentration in health policy and management from the Johns Hopkins University. At this point, please help me welcome Administrator Seema Verma. Welcome.
Well, good morning, and thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you to Dr. Duffy and the members of this important organization for your commitment to the American dialogue. And congratulations on this beautiful new facility. The Commonwealth Club should be applauded for its role in convening discussions about some of our biggest and often contentious issues. But I'm not here to talk about controversial issues. Instead, I'd like to talk to you about things on which we all agree, like the future of our healthcare system and Medicare. And if we've got time, we can touch quickly on world peace before we all leave. Americans enjoy the benefits of the best healthcare providers and innovators in the world. Yet while the volume of care consumed by American patients has not increased dramatically compared to similar economies, the cost of care in the United States has accelerated at an alarming pace. Healthcare costs are growing faster than the United States GDP, making it more difficult with each passing year for CMS to ensure healthcare for generations to come. If we continue on this path, by 2026, our nation will be spending one in every $5 on healthcare. The impact of this for government will mean that healthcare spending will crowd out funding for other priorities like public safety, infrastructure, defense, and education. For businesses, this means fewer dollars to invest and in creating jobs and prosperity. For every American citizen, this means that more and more of our household budgets will be spent on higher premiums, higher deductibles, and higher copays. The status quo is simply unsustainable, and there is no easy solution. Anyone who tells you that more government spending alone can fix this problem doesn't understand the issue, because despite the huge increase in funding we saw from Obamacare, many of our healthcare challenges not only remain, but continue to worsen. As a country, we have not figured out how to slow the rate of growth in healthcare spending. But let me first explain CMS and its role in the larger healthcare delivery system. As you heard, CMS not only serves the 130 million Americans on Medicare and Medicaid, but we also administer the healthcare exchanges, serving an additional 11 million, making us the nation's largest health insurer. Our footprint on the United States healthcare system is so significant that everything we do has a large ripple effect on every American, whether they're a beneficiary or not. That far-reaching impact is on my mind during every decision I make, I remain constantly cognizant of the fact that we are not only responsible to our beneficiaries, but to the entire healthcare system. So as CMS goes, so goes the healthcare market. America's healthcare system's challenges are reflected in the Medicare program, which serves 60 million beneficiaries, nearly 40 million of whom are in the traditional program, where we pay providers directly for their care. Everyone in this room has a loved one or a friend who is on Medicare, and the program has to serve all of their diverse needs. In 2015, 55% of our traditional Medicare beneficiaries had hypertension, 27% had diabetes, and 29% had multiple chronic conditions. But Medicare spending is concentrated on a small proportion of the beneficiaries. The 15% of beneficiaries with six or more chronic conditions accounted for more than 51% of spending in 2015. By the time we all go to bed tonight, approximately 1.3 million Americans in Medicare will have visited a doctor today, and 5 million claims worth $2 billion will be processed. And while these numbers are large, they pale in comparison to where we are headed. CMS receives 10,000 new enrollments into Medicare every day. And we project that by 2030, the program will increase by one-third, from 60 to 80 million beneficiaries. And spending per beneficiary will increase from $13,500 today to almost $25,000 per year in 2030. Despite the burgeoning demand for Medicare services, the reality is the Medicare program is on a troubling trajectory. As decades of neglect by Congress and past administrations have allowed it to travel down a path that is unsustainable. And its problems stem from the fact that many aspects of the program have become detached from its intended purpose to serve the patient. For years, money has been poured into a system that is only increasing in complexity and burden, all the while the patient has been locked out of the process. While there have been warnings for many years about the solvency of Medicare, the truth is, on its current trajectory, the program may not be there for many of us in this room today. Medicare has significant problems, and it starts with the over 11,000 pages of regulations we produce each year. It's mind-numbing, isn't it? While many of them have come with the best of intentions, the cumulative effect has hurt, not helped, our healthcare system. The government cannot spur innovation if it is dictating the process and driving up costs through burdensome regulations. A perfect example of this is that hospitals spend $39 billion a year for regulatory compliance. The law requires that we set prices based on providers' costs, which means that we reward inefficiency and give annual raises whether the provider is improving patient outcomes, delivering quality and value, or not. Medicare pays for things differently based on the site of care, paying more or less for the same service but different locations. Now, sometimes that makes sense, as some facilities provide a higher level of service, but other times it creates misaligned incentives. Decisions about whether a patient receives a service in a hospital or in a doctor's office is influenced by how Medicare pays. Because when we pay more for services provided in a hospital setting than in an office setting, we are encouraging the consolidation of providers around hospital systems. When consolidation gets to the point where there is only one large competitor in a market, prices will go up and the competitive forces that encourage higher quality and lower costs will disappear. In addition, overly burdensome regulations too often stand in the way of providers focusing on innovation and creating value. One key example is the physician self-referral law, also known as the Stark Law. While Stark is an important anti-fraud protection for Medicare, it was enacted in 1989, and it has been interpreted and reinterpreted and is outdated. It has become a significant barrier to innovative arrangements that drive value. And speaking of fraud, program integrity is also an issue at CMS. Due to its sheer size, our programs are always vulnerable to waste and fraud and abuse. However, as the nation's largest healthcare payer, we have a long way to go to preventing it. Commercial payers review claims for services before and after the claim is paid. Currently, the Medicare program only reviews less than 0.3%. That's a really teeny tiny number. 0.3% of the nearly 1.5 billion Medicare claims that CMS pays annually. We need to learn from our private sector colleagues so that we can be more efficient and do an even better job of safeguarding the fiscal integrity of our programs. So that's the bad news. The good news is that the Trump administration prides itself in fulfilling promises, and this president has promised in both his public statements and in his budget to make the preservation and strengthening of Medicare a top priority. We cannot continue to settle for the wrong path. While the challenges that face Medicare and the entire healthcare system are real, this administration will not shy away from them. Abraham Lincoln said, once aptly, "You cannot escape the responsibility of tomorrow by evading it today." So let me share what we are doing today to ensure a better tomorrow, not only for Medicare, but for the entire American healthcare delivery system. I've traveled the country and spent a lot of time with providers from a variety of different settings, and one thing has become completely clear to me. CMS has to modernize and refocus our policies on realigning incentives so that providers deliver value and quality to their patients. CMS's central mission is to transform the healthcare delivery system to one that moves away from delivering volume of services to one that delivers value for patients, one that provides high quality, accessible care at the lowest cost. And while many that have come before me have shared this vision, what is different now is how we get there. This administration is guided by four pillars: empowering patients, increasing competition, realigning incentives, and reducing barriers to value-driven care. As we transition to a system that delivers value to patients, we must start at the very basic level of the interaction that a patient experiences when walking into a doctor's office. We must cater to the needs of the patient, not providers. Our goal is to activate the most powerful force in our healthcare system for creating value: the patient. We will transform the individual patient into a consumer of healthcare, one that is empowered to shop for the provider that delivers the best care at the lowest price. As the American patient is seeking care, they will seek providers that deliver innovative, transformative care, those that leverage the technological efficiencies that we have seen from other industries. But in order for patients to become consumers of healthcare, they must have transparency in pricing and in outcomes so that they can shop for quality and value. To this end, CMS has proposed requiring that hospitals become more transparent with their pricing. This is a small step towards providing our beneficiaries with price transparency, but our work in this area is only just beginning. Price transparency is core to patient empowerment and making sure American patients have the tools they need so that they can make the best decisions for them and their families. As we unpack the contours of empowering patients, let's take, for example, two Americans named Bob and Helen. Bob is a 50-year-old working professional with a chronic illness who sees his retirement and Medicare eligibility on the horizon. He has spent most of his productive years with access to the internet, so he is tech savvy. Helen is an 83-year-old Medicare beneficiary with average health. She prefers in-home healthcare services and visits her doctor frequently. We all know people like Bob and Helen, if we're not already similar to them. One would think that a healthcare system that was set up to serve patients would make serving patients like Bob and Helen a top priority. Unfortunately, the opposite has become the case all too frequently. Instead, it is the system that has become the centerpiece of policy debates, and it is the system that has become more about sustaining itself than serving patients. We believe that the system must be about the patient and for the patient. As I mentioned, Bob is tech savvy and not yet on Medicare. But when he is, and others in his generation become Medicare eligible, they will expect nothing less than a modernized customer interface with Medicare. Through the CMS Digital Seniors Initiative, we are working on a broad set of changes that will enable our seniors to access and navigate the Medicare program more seamlessly and provide the personalized tools to improve the customer experience and help them make the decisions that are best for them. For instance, Bob and Helen should be able to seek providers that are best meeting their needs. And in order to do that, they must have control of their medical records. And they should be able to share that information with a family member, a caretaker, or other healthcare providers, or whomever they choose. Today, unfortunately, many providers are holding patient medical records hostage, not providing patients with access to their own data. This problem became very real to my family almost a year ago. And as I've told this story before, I received a call from my teenage daughter telling me that my husband had collapsed and he was in cardiac arrest in the Philadelphia airport. On my way from D.C. to meet my family, I tried to answer the questions about his medical history for the doctors over the phone and desperately made calls to our doctors back in Indiana to ask for any information in my husband's medical record that could help save his life. Eventually, after running a battery of tests, his life was saved, and we are so grateful to the men and women on his treatment team. A week later, my husband was discharged, and I asked for his medical records so I could give them to the doctors back in Indiana. After a lot of commotion, I was handed some sheets of paper and a CD-ROM. That's right. After the federal government has spent more than $30 billion on electronic health records, I left with paper and a CD-ROM. I don't even think my kids knew what a CD-ROM was. The use of electronic health records has merely replaced paper silos with electronic ones, while providers and patients they serve still have difficulty obtaining health records. We must drive our system to an inoperable one where IT systems work seamlessly with each other, just as cell phones work today. This will allow patients to take their data with them as they move through the healthcare system and ensure that their providers have all of the information possible to make the right diagnosis and treatment for their patients. To make this vision a reality, CMS, in partnership with the White House Office of American Innovation, led by Jared Kushner, launched a government-wide initiative called My Healthy Data. This initiative envisions a future in which Helen and Bob will have access to their own health data. CMS is using every lever we can to make it clear that the patient owns their data and they must have access to their information. We have proposed both penalties and incentive for providers to make this clear, and we have asked for comment on whether we should make interoperability a requirement for providers that participate in the Medicare program. But My Healthy Data is more than just patients and doctors getting healthcare records. It's about driving a new era of digital health, one that will unleash data to trigger innovation and advance research to cure diseases and provide more evidence-based treatment guidelines that ultimately will drive down costs and improve health outcomes. As part of My Healthy Data, CMS announced a major step to enable Medicare beneficiaries to obtain and control their claims data in a digital format and share them with whoever they choose. This means that Helen can securely direct all of the data that Medicare has about her to researchers, or she can direct it to new apps and products that can help her and her healthcare providers better manage her health. This new tool is called Blue Button 2.0, and more than 100 innovators, many that are in the Bay Area, have since joined the program. And the first wave of new applications will begin to revolutionize healthcare. We've put our Medicare Advantage plans on notice that they too need to give beneficiaries access to their data in a way that patients can use it. Liberating data will drive innovation throughout the entire healthcare system and creating new tools and solutions that will allow the system to deliver value to patients. And to further spur innovation in this era of digital health, CMS is releasing Medicare Advantage data sets, and next year we expect to make Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program data available. These data sets will provide researchers and innovators with data on a new population of 70 million beneficiaries. And once all of this data becomes available, advancements in artificial intelligence will make it possible to analyze the data at the speed of light, and the possibilities are endless. Already, precision medicine is producing groundbreaking treatments tailor-made to a patient's genetic code. Imagine how much faster we can go at developing new treatments when we have more complete data. A patient's entire health history from birth onwards, right at our fingertips. As we try to bend the cost growth curve and deliver value for our patients, we need to lean into innovation as a way to provide more cost-effective, higher quality care that improves outcomes. We are constantly surrounded by amazing innovations that have the ability to help us bring better care and lower costs to our patients. And as CMS administrator, it's a priority to ensure our policies support and drive innovation across the entire healthcare system. So for those of you who love Bill Murray movies, you may be asking by now, what about Bob? When patients like Bob come into Medicare, they will expect the program to provide the latest technology. And just recently, CMS proposed to have Medicare start paying for virtual check-ins, meaning patients can connect with their doctors by phone or video chat. In addition, our proposal would allow patients to text an image to providers for review, and we're expanding the list of Medicare services that can be delivered via telehealth. Transportation can be a barrier to care for our elderly and disabled populations, and paying for these types of services is an example of how CMS is leveraging new technology to increase access to care for Medicare beneficiaries, and how CMS is delivering on President Trump's promise to strengthen the Medicare program. Last fall, the president also issued an executive order called Healthcare Choice and Competition Across the United States. The president believes that competition is the key ingredient to driving down healthcare spending. And I couldn't agree more that this is a critical component to improving our healthcare delivery system, and we are using every lever at our disposal at CMS to create a system that drives competition amongst providers to compete for patients. Because when there is competition, there is a drive to innovation and value. And there is no better example of how competition drives value than the Medicare Advantage program. This is a great example of how incentives are aligned to drive competition that increases value for our patients. In Medicare Advantage, the government pays a fixed amount, and health plans manage this budget. CMS measures the plans on quality, and this information is provided to our beneficiaries to help them select the plan that they want. Health plans compete to attract beneficiaries through low premiums, provider networks, and enhanced benefits. Beneficiaries like Helen can choose the plan that best meets her needs. Thus, it comes as little surprise that enrollment in Medicare Advantage has been increasing year after year, now reaching over 1 in 3 Medicare beneficiaries. Plans also provide value to the Medicare Trust Fund since they have to operate within the capitated payments. Our administration has worked to support innovation in the Medicare Advantage program. We have given plans more flexibility to offer more choices to beneficiaries and rid the plans of burdensome requirements that deterred them from devoting resources to beneficiaries. And starting in 2019, we're giving plans more flexibility so that they can cover more types of supplemental benefits, which go beyond the traditional Medicare benefits. So this could include modifications to help keep seniors like Helen safe in their homes and out of institutions, with equipment like wheelchair ramps and stair rails or grab bars, more in-home support services, and respite care for her caregivers. The key here is that plans have the ability to shape a supplemental package that can provide flexibility to tailor benefits to beneficiaries that can improve health outcomes and lower costs, but that also appeal to beneficiaries. And beneficiaries have the power to shop for a plan that has provided the most value for their needs. And while Medicare Advantage sets up the right financial incentives to deliver value, unfortunately, the rest of the Medicare program does not. Our current program not only encourages volume, it also thwarts price competition. All providers are paid the same, whether they provide value or not. And the system actually rewards providers that provide the most service rather than those that produce value and better health outcomes for the patients they serve. Medicare's payment incentives are often upside down. And until Congress makes changes, CMS is pushing forward by using our Innovation Center to test out new ways of paying for care. Moving forward, our models will focus on the areas in the healthcare system that are driving up costs. This includes focusing on individuals that are seriously ill. And as I said in the beginning of my remarks, we know we have to figure out a better way to provide care for our beneficiaries with chronic disease. We want to think about innovative ways to treat these individuals that realign incentives for providers to focus first on improving quality of life, quality of care, while also lowering costs. Many of the Innovation Center's efforts have focused on encouraging coordinated care, and that's important. But ultimately, our goal is to align financial incentives around providing care that is patient-centric. Early results indicate that we get better outcomes in terms of quality and cost when providers are responsible for managing a complete budget. Unfortunately, Only about 11% of providers in Medicare are participating in this type of payment. In order for us to transform into a value-based system, we need to encourage providers to take responsibility for managing the healthcare budget for their patients. Because when the budget is set, we can waive a lot more regulations, program integrity rules, which give them more flexibility to focus on innovation, quality, and patient needs instead of following CMS's rules. Over the coming months, we will create new opportunities for primary care doctors who are best positioned amongst providers to help patients and providers to drive value. We want to focus on upstream providers, not hospitals, to eliminate unnecessary downstream costs. In addition, we will be developing models that move away from the government price setting to allow for competitive bidding amongst providers and creating new financial incentives for our beneficiaries to shop for quality and value as they seek high-value providers for their care.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Finally, we will use our demonstration authority to do more on program integrity. We need to modernize Medicare and how it handles waste, fraud, and abuse. We need to prevent inappropriate care on the front end. It's what the private industry is doing, and CMS needs to catch up. This administration is dedicated to putting patients first, to be empowered consumers of healthcare that have the information they need to be engaged and active decision makers in their care. And through this empowerment, there will be a competitive advantage for providers that deliver coordinated quality care at the best value to attract patients who are shopping for value. And CMS fully recognizes in order to improve Helen's experience in Medicare, she must have more access to and attention from her doctor. We've all been to the doctor, and let's be honest, there's a lot more screen time going on than eye time. And all of us at some point have waited weeks or missed work or undergone some type of inconvenience so that we can drive to the doctor, fill out paperwork, and watch our doctor stare at a computer screen. And to be fair, no brilliant physician wants to be relegated to data entry while their time with patients continues to evaporate. It is clear that our regulations have held back innovation. And if we're going to be driving to a system that drives value, lower costs, and creates better health outcomes, we need to remove barriers that thwart this effort. As part of the President's Cut the Red Tape initiative, CMS launched our Patients Over Paperwork initiative to reduce unnecessary and redundant regulations so that doctors could focus on their primary mission, taking care of their patients. Last year, we asked providers to share with us their ideas and concerns around regulations, and we've received over 3,000 comments. The agency has been busy addressing those concerns. And one of the biggest complaints we heard was around the burden of reporting quality measures. So we began an initiative, and brilliantly, we called it Meaningful Measures. That's right. If there's one thing the government can really do, it's name something. Meaningful Measures is about continuing to focus on evaluating quality, safety, program integrity, but recognizing that in our drive to value and innovation, we can't weigh providers down with reporting that doesn't make sense. This year, we have overhauled our measures, getting rid of the ones that were duplicative, topped out, process-oriented, or just not meaningful to patient care. Now, I'm supportive of quality measures that mean something to providers and patients, but we also have to make sure that we have the back-end processes in place to evaluate quality without the provider having to take active steps around reporting. CMS has proposed the elimination of reporting requirements for over 100 measures across the entire healthcare delivery system, saving providers more than $175 million over the next 2 years. And another major step we have taken is around billing. We also heard from providers that the amount of documentation we require for providers to bill CMS is excessive, burdensome, and outdated. We just recently announced an overhaul of the entire billing system that will save, listen to this, 500 years of doctor time in just 1 year. Doctors will see very minimal impact on their payments, and any impact should be offset by the massive reduction in burden and increased efficiency. This will give doctors more time to provide their patients with innovative care. Now, no discussion of Medicare or value in healthcare would be complete without a discussion of drug pricing. This is our fastest growing area of spend. In 2012, Medicare spent 17% of its total budget on prescription drugs. 4 years later, in 2016, spending had increased to 23%, or $174 billion. For Medicare, spending on prescription drugs is growing more quickly than spending in any other area. And President Trump has been clear that he wants to lower prescription drug costs and make sure that Americans are getting the best deal as they pay for their medications. And I can tell you that this is a very important issue for him, and he brings this topic up almost in every conversation I have with him. Secretary Azar, with his deep industry experience, has deployed a four-pronged strategy as outlined in the American Patients First Blueprint, focused on lowering list prices, reducing out-of-pocket costs, increasing competition, and strengthening negotiations. And already we're seeing drug manufacturers responding to the president's leadership, and some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world announce that they are either lowering their list prices or freezing them. The problem of drug pricing is especially acute when with new drugs that are coming to market with extremely high price tags, drugs that are only taken about once and intended to be curative or to address diseases that impact a small number of patients. Today, Medicare is a price taker in our Part B program. We don't negotiate, and manufacturers can charge whatever they want. And Medicare incentivizes them to charge more because doctors that prescribe their drugs are paid on a percentage of the cost of the drug. So the more the drug costs, the more the doctor gets. Another example of misaligned financial incentives in Medicare that are driving up costs. We need to rethink how we are paying for drugs and ensure that Medicare is negotiating the best deal for beneficiaries. In an era where we are seeing drugs priced at over $500,000, we need to modernize the way Medicare pays for drugs in Part B. And to this end, we are looking at value-based payment mechanisms. So, for example, payment would only be made for a drug if it was proven to be effective in terms of clinical outcomes or reducing total cost of care. Before I conclude, and I will save you from a discussion about world peace, I want to address one additional issue. We have all heard the drumbeat for what advocates of a government-run, socialized healthcare system call Medicare for All. Let me briefly explain why this notion reveals a fundamental lack of understanding about the uniqueness of Medicare to the very specific population that it serves. First, Medicare is a program to provide care to our most vulnerable, disabled, and aging population that needs it. Second, by proposing to expand services offered by Medicare to every American, you further strain Medicare's funding streams and run the risk of depriving seniors of the coverage they have worked their entire lives to receive. We have just discussed the challenges that Medicare faces in serving the nation's seniors. The misaligned financial systems that are driving up costs and the bureaucratic hurdles faced by doctors and hospitals. We have a lot of work to do to strengthen the existing Medicare program. Putting millions more Americans on Medicare will undermine the health care for the very demographic the program is designed to assist. Ideas like Medicare for All would only serve to hurt and divert focus from seniors. All the while expanding the regulatory burden and the misaligned and perverse incentives of a government-run system. In essence, Medicare for All would become Medicare for None. By choosing a socialized system, you are giving the government complete control over the decisions pertaining to your care or whether you receive care at all. It would be the furthest thing from patient-centric care. Let's learn from the mistakes made in Medicaid when the Affordable Care Act pushed millions of able-bodied Americans into a program designed for pregnant women, children, aged, and those with disabilities, only to then incentivize states to serve the able-bodied before protecting Americans most in need. We have seen this movie, and the last thing we need to see is the sequel. I seriously hope that those who advocate it take the time to understand the complexity of the program and the adverse consequences of their proposal. Rather than straining Medicare, we are working to strengthen Medicare. We are activating patients to be consumers of healthcare, to drive providers to compete for patients by innovating and providing value. We are getting rid of burdensome regulations that are barriers to value-based care while realigning incentives so that providers can focus on delivering care that improves quality and lowers cost. We are running out of time to solve the challenges of our healthcare system. Not addressing healthcare costs not only threatens the future of the Medicare program, but our country's future. This administration will never stop driving our system towards delivering value for the patient. This will take every single part of the healthcare system working together to ensure that we continue to drive towards value. Everybody will need to do their part to create a value-based system, but we need you to do your part as well. Please engage with us. We need and want your ideas and your unique perspective. At some point, we're all going to be Medicare beneficiaries, so let's work together to strengthen the program and leverage that strength for the future of our entire healthcare delivery system. This is not a luxury, but a necessity. The prosperity and the well-being of future generations is dependent on the decisions that we make today. So join us as we ensure those decisions will benefit all Americans. Thank you.
Our thanks to Seema Verma, the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, for those remarks. Now it's time for some questions. I have a lot, and boy, I got a whole bunch from this audience, which reflect people who care a lot and know a lot. I promise I will not get to all of these, but I will do what I can to get to many of them. I think several of them touch on one of the last things that you mentioned, not only sort of single-payer health care, which is a big issue, but generally the Trump administration and the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And just this morning, the Kaiser Family Foundation had a poll they released that said that 56% of Americans think that the Trump administration is trying to make the law fail. Okay, and critics point to certain things that have been done there overall. And about a similar percentage also feel that the administration is responsible for whatever happens going forward. So I'm curious about this because I know you and I know other Trump administration officials definitely want American health care to succeed. But what about the Affordable Care Act? Does the administration want the Affordable Care Act to fail? And if so, how do you think about those things?
I think this administration wants to make sure that all Americans have access to high quality, accessible care. The problems with the Affordable Care Act started long before the Trump administration came to office. In 2016, we were seeing the mass exodus of insurance carriers that did not want to offer coverage on the exchanges. We were seeing premiums go up by over 100%, and you were seeing many people that couldn't afford coverage. What we were seeing is not only higher prices, but reduced choices of plans. I think the other thing that we've heard from people across the country, even before we came into office, is that even the plans that were being offered had very limited networks, high deductibles. So even if you were able to get a plan, even if you had a subsidy, the type of plan you had, you couldn't see the doctor you wanted to see, and you had so very, very high out-of-pocket expenses. So this program was failing long before this administration came into office. And the reality is it's not going to get fixed, and it's not going to get better until Congress addresses it. We've tried to do what we can do. I think in the first year, we put out a market stabilization rule. We've put out another regulation at the end of last year to give more flexibility to states so that they could take control over what was going on in their healthcare markets. And so we've done a lot of different things to help the program. But again, I don't think we're going to be successful without changes by Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, the good news is I understand from the insurance industry that a lot of things have stabilized with it overall. So the question is whether the administration is trying to help the exchanges, for example, or not right now.
You know, I think that the bottom line is the program has some underlying structural flaws. And we can try to take action in one way or the other, but the bottom line is the program's not going to work. It wasn't working when we came to office, and it continues not to work. We still are hearing about double-digit rate increases. The program is not designed to be successful.
Okay. That's I think, an area still of some debate. But I'd like to turn to the bigger issue that people have brought up and that you raised about single-payer health care. I'm not going to ask the question that you already answered. I know the administration is not in favor of it. I do find that many people confuse single-payer health care with universal coverage, mm-hmm. right? Not the same thing. Many countries have both, but not the same thing. So clearly the administration is not in favor of a single-payer approach. What's the Trump administration's feeling about having everybody having health care coverage?
I think we've always said that we want to make sure that people have access to coverage. That's always been a goal of the administration. I just don't think that the government is the one to make decisions for each and every American. People need to make decisions about their health care on their own. They need to have choices and options, and they need to make the decisions that are going to work best for them. We don't think that the government should be making decisions about individual families and for people about their health care. That should come from the individual.
And when you say access to coverage, is that the same as coverage?
We want people to have access to coverage. And I think we've been very clear about making sure that there's access in a lot of different ways. I think that what we've had through Obamacare is a type of plan, a very expensive plan that lots of people can't afford. And different people want different types of plans. And I think that they should be able to make the choices for decide, you know, what's going to work best for them.
Mm-hmm. So we have through the Affordable Care Act, about half the number of uninsured in America. We still have, 8 or 9%, whatever that might be. And granted, the coverage for everybody is not optimal. So just being covered is not all that we need. However, we still have 8 or 9%, and more in some states, less in others. What's the Trump administration's plan to try to get that number up pretty close to 100?
So a couple of things that we've done. I mean, what we're seeing in the exchanges is that the coverage has become very expensive. And for people that are subsidized, they're not necessarily experiencing issues in terms of getting access to the coverage. They still may have a lot of problems in affording the out-of-pocket expenses and the very high deductibles. But a lot of people cannot afford the coverage, and they're not able to get subsidies. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is make sure that there's different types of options available, providing more flexibility with short-term limited duration plans. We put out a proposed rule, association health plans. And the idea there is to create more flexibility and more options for consumers to be able to have different choices, because I don't think that everybody can afford the one-size-fits-all Obamacare approach, a very expensive plan that's leaving out millions of Americans.
Now, we just heard over the past week in terms of the association health plans, I know there have been some new rules there, that one of the groups that was most in favor of it didn't feel like the new rules were sufficient for it to pursue. So are there other plans to do something else in that regard?
No, we're always going to be continuing to drive towards giving Americans options. I think that the way Obamacare is structured is it's a one-size-fits-all approach. And so you're going to see action by the agency, and I think that's what the president, you know, in terms of his executive order, wants to make sure that there's different types of plans available so that people have choices about their care.
Okay. One of the statements the president's made that has gotten a lot of excitement on the right and increasing interest on the left is the notion of giving states much more flexibility in how they administer health care to their residents. There's concern on the left that maybe states won't do what they want overall, but of course, you've talked about experimentation. We had your predecessor, Andy Slavitt, here just two nights ago, and he talked about the importance of states experimenting. He said some very complimentary things about you as well, I should say. Here in California, as you've probably heard, we have a gubernatorial race. Most of the candidates are running on some kind of platform about single-payer health care on a statewide basis. Plenty of challenge to that. But I guess my question to you is that should that platform go forward, it would require, I suppose, waivers from the federal government so that the monies that currently flow through your department would be put into the California single-payer pool. Should that happen, should that be requested, what would be your feeling about granting California that flexibility?
Well, I don't think a single-payer system is going to work, number one. I think that a lot of the analysis has showed is that it's unaffordable and that it would actually, you know, put many people in a situation where the government's making decisions about their health care. We've been consistent that we support flexibility. But when we look at proposals, we evaluate them to see, are they fiscally sustainable? Are they fiscally sustainable for the federal government as well as the state? So when we're evaluating proposals, that's what we're looking at. We're looking to see whether the proposal, you know, falls within the confines of the law. But it doesn't make sense for us to waste time on something that's not going to work.
So that would be a no, then, most likely.
It, like I said, our parameters are it has to be fiscally sustainable for the federal government.
Okay. And, of course, at this point, you rightly pointed out, there's a concern about Medicare as it's put together being fiscally sustainable. We have, again, another projection, as we've had over the last number of decades, that Medicare will be out of dollars by such and such a date. In the past, it's been as short as 2 years in the future, and we've always managed. Do you believe that with the kinds of policies you've mentioned here, we will make enough of a dent in this cost monster that will be able to salvage Medicare?
Well, first of all, the president has put his budget together, which would increase the solvency of the Medicare program. So we've already taken that step. I think that the policies that we've outlined today are important not only for Medicare, but they're really at the core of trying to address some of the underlying problems within the healthcare delivery system. We don't believe that just throwing more money at the system is going to solve the problem. We've got to really change how the system is working and make sure that we are aligning incentives to work well for providers, but that aligning the incentives in a way that focus on patients.
Okay. Another item that's been in the news a lot are work requirements for Medicaid. There's ideological issues around this, whether people should have to work in order to earn the benefits. There's practical issues about how much it costs to administer that. There are legal issues now as well, because I guess the first waiver that you granted, Kentucky, recently was overturned by a judge or blocked by a judge for now and so forth. I know there's seven more states, I believe, that have waiver applications
that's
pending.
Close to about 11, 12.
11 or 12 now, wow. So given that recently this judge said no to work requirements in Kentucky for Medicaid, what are your thoughts about the additional waivers or additional plans in that regard?
Well, first of all, our response on what we call community engagement was really a response to states that wanted more flexibility in their programs. As the Affordable Care Act put more able-bodied Americans into the Medicaid program, they wanted the flexibility to serve these patients and their particular needs. These are able-bodied individuals that are living in poverty or near the poverty level. And those individuals need more than health care. They need a pathway out of poverty. And some of these initiatives around community engagement were designed to help these individuals, give them the skills they need, the job training, and connecting them to resources that can help them have a better life. And so we've always said we want to be responsive to state needs and give them the type of flexibility that they need to serve their patient populations appropriately. We're committed to this effort. We think that looking at poverty programs across the entire federal government. We want to focus on giving people a better life and creating a pathway out of poverty. So we're committed to that. We are looking at the court's concerns and trying to figure out a way to address that, but we're committed to this issue.
It's been interesting to me that it doesn't fall quite as neatly along ideological lines as I had thought it would originally for a variety of reasons. I think some of the most exciting things that you're talking about, because they make sense and they have bipartisan support, is the move from volume to value, right? You have support on the right and the left there. You had support in the Obama administration for that as well. We got a number of questions about that, more about some of the specifics, including a few saying, what are the most exciting, promising, specific initiatives you've seen in this move from volume to value?
Well, a couple of things first. I think that in the way that this was being approached in the past, I think there was a couple of issues there. One, what we feel has been missing is the patient in all of this, right? All of the incentives are for the providers, and we really want to empower the patient so that they can be a part of this as well. I think the second thing that we've been concerned about is we've looked at the way a lot of these payment models have been set up. If they've been set up in a way that actually is encouraging consolidation in the marketplace and that actually is reducing competition. So we're very concerned about that. The third area that I would focus on is providers, and I sort of talked about this in my speech, being responsible for the budget. Essentially what we call managing risk, upside and downside. It's basically if you spend more or spend less, but being responsible for the total cost of care. What we see in our results is that when the providers are responsible for managing the entire budget, we get better results. And I think what we've seen is some of the policies in the past that, you know, essentially only reward them if they're saving money, but if they're losing money, there's no impact or no penalty. And we, you know, after examining those programs, we feel like that's not the most effective way. And we need to think about models that really encourage providers to take responsibility for the budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm with you. And, you know, this Zetima group I run has people from across the political spectrum, including several of your predecessors. And everybody's on board with the concept. At the same time, there's been a number of studies out recently that show that although we've had a lot of activity in the volume to value transition, bundled payments, accountable care, and so forth, really the results, the impact on the healthcare system has been minimal. Mm-hmm. And I would think that your challenge would be is how quickly can you make that fairly substantial transition? Because if you double or triple what's happened, that won't make that much of a difference before 2020. So what can you do? How fast can you do more of this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think I talked about this in the speech, that we only have about 11% of the providers in Medicare that are participating in some type of a value-based arrangement.
That's just participation. That's not like 11%
exactly.
Of are doing it completely.
No,
right?
And no. Not only that, but you're right. And so the type of risk that they're taking is not even full risk, right? Yeah. It could just be a partial risk. Or partial management of the budget. So we're very concerned about that. I think one of the things that we want to see is we need to have more models. We need to have more ways of allowing providers to participate. As I look at the market, I don't think you're going to have every single provider willing to take on the entire budget. Some of them may be able to do that, but some of them may only want to do that in some small way. And then there may be providers that are not wanting to engage in any type of management for the budget. And I think in that particular area, we still need to create incentives around delivering value. So we're going to be taking aim at all of those areas, but that's something that we continue to work on with the entire healthcare community.
Well, it's a big challenge since really the issue you talk about of cost, which is probably the nub of the core of all these issues, that cost is basically being spent on Americans, right? And it's one out of 11 healthcare jobs, it's 1/6 of our economy. Ultimately, if we're going to tame the cost monster, it's going to take some dollars away from people's incomes. We're going to close hospitals. We're going to have to do things that are hard. And I know it's hard for somebody in politics to talk about the hard stuff, but if you're successful in taming the cost monster, whose ox will be gored?
You know, we don't look at it as, you know, I think what we outlined in terms of the approach is focusing on competition, focusing on innovation, value, empowering the patients. This isn't something that we're going to do one magic bullet and we're going to focus on one set of providers. This is something that we need to address across the entire healthcare delivery system. We need to change incentives, encourage competition, encourage value. Looking at program integrity, that's across every single provider. Mm-hmm. So it's a comprehensive approach, but I don't think that we, you know, have it in for one particular set of providers. I think it's just looking at this comprehensively.
Okay. I applaud your effort to try to reduce regulation where we can, or to make regulations smarter. And something that you've written about, you didn't speak too much about here, is the notion that is the fact that Medicare may often pay the same doctor doing the same procedure in the same building for the same patient two different rates, depending on whether that building is classified as part of a hospital system, a hospital outpatient system, or a doctor's office, which of course is causing hospitals to buy these places, reclassify them, and literally double the reimbursement overnight. So you've mentioned that as a bad idea. It is a bad idea. Do you, in your capacity, have the power to change that? Does that take legislation? What do you plan to do about that?
As you said, we've identified that as a major issue. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense for taxpayers, and it certainly doesn't make sense for patients because they end up having to pay more depending on the site of service. I think you're going to see that even in the payment rules, last year, we started to address this issue. We focused on, I think you're going to see more coming from us on this. I think that's the type of, it's a great example of some of the bizarre things in the Medicare program that just don't make sense and that are actually having a perverse incentive on the entire healthcare delivery system, right? Because as you have that type of consolidation going on and you've got hospitals buying up, different physician offices, you create a monopoly in that healthcare delivery system. And if you have just one provider system, we know where costs are going to go up. They're going to continue to rise. So I think you're going to see us take that issue very seriously, and there should be changes on the way.
Great. Well, the move from volume to value, if you really have more of an accountable situation where, as you say, health systems have responsibilities for budgets and large populations, makes a lot of those incentive problems go away and a lot of the fraud and abuse problems go away, which is great. As we talked about, the hard part is how do you get there fairly rapidly? And I don't know we have an answer to that. You did bring up drug prices and drug costs. In fact, I want to make sure we distinguish those, distinguish the costs of drugs to the system, which is a problem, with the amount that patients pay out of pocket, which is another problem. They're related, but they're not the same. Mm-hmm. And if you could wave a magic wand and reduce drug costs to Medicare by 10%, doesn't mean there'd be much of an impact on patients very quickly, right? If you've got a $25 deductible in your plan, that doesn't necessarily change overnight and so forth. So I guess my question for you is there, which is the higher priority for you, getting the total cost down or figuring out how to have patients spend less out of their own pockets?
Well, I think that's not entirely correct. I mean, patients are paying, first of all, they're paying premiums, right? When they're buying their Part D plans. In Part B, they're also paying for their medications, and sometimes they have co-pays, but they also have co-insurance, and so they are paying a percentage of the cost of their drug. And the way our system works today with rebate system, you know, the plan may actually negotiate a lower cost of the drug, but the patient is paying their percentage of the drug based on the list price. So they're not getting the benefit of all the behind-the-scenes negotiations around rebates. So that's one of the things that this administration is focused on. We want to make sure that the patient gets the best deal possible. I think we've all heard the stories about how you can get drugs overseas at a much lower cost than what Americans are paying, and that's also something that the administration is very focused on.
Yeah, we saw some news about that this week. You got a hard job, and I certainly appreciate you taking it on overall. Thank you for your service there. I do mean that. Unfortunately, we've come to the time in the program where we have time for just one more question. And given that you're in a position, you take a lot of fire, the administration takes a lot of fire, but we're all trying to make things work better together. So I want to sort of end on a more hopeful note or a hopeful question. And that is this, you know, something that I think you may have mentioned the results of in passing, but I think it's worth pointing out, and that is that in February of this year, in a rare and actually surprisingly quiet display of bipartisanship, Congress passed and the president signed the Chronic Care Act, which is I think is fairly meaningful in terms of what it can do. Just for those who aren't aware, just significant policy advances trying to help in integrated patient-centered care, as they say, but particularly giving more flexibility, particularly to Medicare Advantage plans, to be able to offer services that go beyond the typical medical things. They include that, of course, but also they can be transportation. It can be if an elderly person might fall and slip in the shower, they can install a shower bar, pay for that, pay for aid. So a lot of things that make a lot of sense. It's greater flexibility. And there was bipartisan agreement, and I think that's wonderful. So my question for you is, where is the other low-hanging bipartisan fruit? What can we do in healthcare? We can get support. There's plenty of things to argue about, and they're good arguments, but what can we do? Where do you see moving forward where you can get political support across the spectrum?
You know, I think at the end of the day, all public servants, all the folks in Washington are there because they want to help solve the problems that our country faces. I think that at the end of the day, when we sort of put aside partisan politics, we realize that we have a major issue on our hands. We cannot continue to have healthcare costs increase. If we're spending 20% of all of our costs on healthcare, that's just not sustainable. That's going to take away and divert resources from other areas that are priority for the administration, for the government, for all of our priorities. And so I think at the end of the day, I see a lot of folks in Washington that are focused on trying to solve the problems. And this administration is going to be a part of that. And this administration is going to be leading that.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of one item that we might be able to make forward progress on that's not going to be particularly controversial across the political spectrum?
Well, I think you're going to be seeing a lot more from CMS. You know, just over the past few weeks, I think we've released a lot of innovative ideas, innovative proposals. We're looking forward to hearing from the healthcare community on some of those ideas. I think some of the work that we've done will be transformative, not only for the healthcare delivery system, but, you know, as I referenced in my speech, for the experience that every patient has when they go see their doctor.
Great. Well, we'll leave it at that. I want to thank Seema Verma, the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Also want to thank our wonderful audience here in San Francisco, as well as those on radio and on the internet. And now, I'm Mark Zitter, by the way, of the Zetima Project. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.